My name is Kara Ginger and your host of the Biteable Podcast, Know Better, Live Best. Today's guest is Peter Bick, professor of practice at Arizona State University in both the School of Sustainability and the Cronkite School of Journalism. He is also the director, producer, and writer of the documentary Carbon Nation and recently completed a series of 11 short films focused on regenerative grazing called Soil Carbon Cowboys. Listen as we discuss Peter's latest documentary and research project, Climate Change and Regenerative Agriculture. Know Better, Live Best is dedicated to supporting food and health literacy in people of all ages. Our mission is to cut through the misinformation surrounding food, health, and nutrition, because we believe that when people know better, they can make the right choices and live their best lives. We are presented by Biteable Foods. They use blockchain and Internet of Things technology to build traceable, transparent food systems, because it shouldn't take an investigative journalist to find out where food comes from. Hello, I am here with Peter Bick. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Okay, how about yourself?
I'm awesome. So I'm really excited to have you on. I've read a ton about you and everything I've heard is amazing. So I'm going to go ahead, instead of me talking about it, I would like you to tell us a little about yourself and your background.
Well, first of all, I get to wear a sweater today. It's chilly in Phoenix, so I'm very excited about that. You had a snow day, I understand, but at least we had a sweater day. So
what's a sweater day for you?
It's only got up into the 60s.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy. But 60s here, and then it went down to the low 40s last night.
You know, it is about what you get used to.
Yeah, it is about what you get used to. So I'm a documentary filmmaker. My first feature-length documentary was a film called Garbage, and that won the South by Southwest Film Festival in the mid-90s. And then my next documentary is a film called Carbon Nation, which was about solutions to climate change. Our tagline is a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. And that film came out in 2010 and then 2011. And we found all sorts of solutions that made sense because they were about good business decisions or good national security decisions. And so folks like my Uncle Phil, who was sending me climate denier articles the whole time I was making that film about solutions to climate change. You know, he was a great touchstone for me because it's just the way it is right now. There's a lot of people who, for one reason or another, don't think climate change is happening or don't think humans are causing it. I certainly know it's happening and know humans are causing it, but that doesn't stop me from listening to people who disagree. And folks like to be asked, what do you think? They don't like to be told you're an idiot. So... One of the things we learned in making the film was a sort of a no blame, no shame approach. And when I ask people, what do you think about climate change? They appreciate being asked. And that's just the way we roll. So then in the Carbon Nation research is when I was really discovered that soils hold an enormous power for slowing down climate change and actually for making it worse, depending on how we're treating our soils. When we treat them poorly, they actually emit carbon. They release carbon because carbon is a natural part of soils. Soils are an ecosystem of life, and a lot of that life is based on carbon. And when the soils get plowed, when they're left with nothing growing on them, rain and wind cause erosion, and then that carbon's released. But when you keep the soils covered with plants, a lot of different types of plants, not just one crop, but a lot of different types of plants, then those roots go deep, they go to different levels, and they helped create a whole world of microbial life that feeds the plants. The plants feed the microbial life, and it's this great system of symbiosis, which is the way nature intended it. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's a natural system. So if we can figure out how to grow our food with that symbiosis thriving, we need less fertilizer, we need less pesticide, we need less herbicide, we don't have to kill plants, we actually grow them, and then they help us grow the soil's nutrient machinery, and that nutrient machinery gets nutrients into our food, and whether you just eat the plants or whether you eat the animals that eat the plants or you eat both, that's what looks to be the best way to do it. And so my next round of documentaries is all about that, specifically about grazing, and that series is called SoilCarbonCowboys.com.
You know, this is amazing. A couple of years ago, I would say I was pretty naive to most of this
that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the more I've gone through my journey to better health for my body, to, you know, be around for my children and be more energized as a kindergarten teacher and just enjoy life. I know, enjoy life all around. This is where it's led me. And it makes sense now, but I would not have guessed that a long time ago that I'm, you know, worried about basically the health of our planet. Mm-hmm. But what I've also learned, and I'm excited about tonight as well, is that there are ways to help it, and almost, I mean, I'm hoping, I'll see what you have to say, you know, reverse it or slow it down, mm-hmm. like you said. And so that gives me hope, because instead it's, you know, I'm just worried about what's going on, but now what can we do to help that? So I am really excited to have you on tonight for everyone to hear this, and maybe hopefully some things that we can do or documentaries to watch to help us get us going.
Yeah, well, the top line concept that what's healthiest for us is what's healthiest for the planet. Like, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like what's best for human beings is really bad for the planet. It's just we've narrowed the scope of what we think is what's best for human beings, which is to make the cheapest food possible and to discount what that toll is on our health. And by separating the cost of food from the cost of healthcare, we're creating an unrealistic story. It's not based on the truth, which is our food is our healthcare. So when you put really cheaply produced food in with our healthcare costs, it's not cheap at all. You know, healthcare is a huge industry for a reason. And so that's, to me, some of the best news, is that what nature wants is actually what our human bodies want. And it's actually what the bodies of the animals that we're eating want, if we eat animals. There's lots of folks who don't eat animals. Mm-hmm. But they need healthy food and nutrient-dense food, and that's based on soil health. And some of the fastest ways that I'm seeing when I'm talking to farmers and ranchers and scientists to get us to that soil health is letting the animals graze around on the land, then grow the food, and have that all happening at the same season. So you don't have to have land that's just made for cattle to graze or land that's just made to grow corn. You can do all sorts of things on the same land in the same growing season. It's what Gabe Brown calls stacking enterprises, and Will Harris down in Georgia. Will Harris does it with just meats. He does chickens and like fowl and beef and pig and all sorts of stuff. And Gabe Brown does it with meat and corn and chickens and sheep. Oh. So the idea that you can grow a whole lot of stuff on the same land with the same rainfall, that's something that's just not really talked about in any of the scientific research I've seen. Not that I've seen all of it, and I have not. But the idea that you can get all that productivity out of 1 acre, to me, is also a good reason to feel good. It's just a question of, how do we get more and more farmers to think along those lines? It's more creative.
It's right.
How many farmers want to be creative? How many farmers want to think of things that they haven't been taught, but they want to think of things that like inherently feels right to them? That's the challenge.
Well, and change, I'm sure, in many areas is just hard. And so is it something that they want to do? And is it something with what you're doing, getting that word out there, that hopefully over time it's out there and they've heard about it a lot, and then you kind of start taking hopefully the smaller steps in that direction?
Yeah, well, changing the way anyone does anything has to be a well-respected event. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to change. It's difficult for me to use a different editing software to make this film versus that film. And that's just me sitting in an office. And that's not me managing livestock on my great-grandfather's land. And if I mess up, my grandkids don't get this land. Right. I do not know that stress. I respect it a lot, but I don't know it in a personal level. But what I'm seeing from all the farmers that we filmed all over the U.S. from many different ecosystems, ecoregions like North Dakota and Mississippi and California and then up into Canada and over into England, is that the farmers who focus on soil health primarily are producing more food on the same land, spending much less money on all their operating costs, equipment, chemical inputs, fertilizers, and they're making more money when they sell their food. And so just about all of them have told me that they got themselves out of debt. And so to be out of debt must be an enormously relieving feeling. I've certainly carried debt of a home and carried debt from credit cards, and that never feels good.
No.
Luckily, I have a job that at least I have a flow of income, you know, as I teach at Arizona State University. But and most farmers I know, they don't even have that flow as much as they want from their farms. They have off-farm jobs. Most farmers that I've met have an off-farm job, and I haven't met any farmers that want their off-farm job. Maybe one. But the rest of them wish they could make as much money as they need to stay on the farm. And so that's an issue. Like, that means our farmers aren't making enough money to farm, but they're feeding us and
right.
Your children and my children. You know, that to me is like as bad as teachers not making enough money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good teachers. I just think that good teachers, good farmers, I want them making good money. I like that.
Oh, I agree. I respect farmers so much, and they shouldn't have to feel that extra burden of going outside of their passion. Like you said, they're feeding us. That's a big deal. We all need that, and it needs to be done. And again, what I respect about you is that you're open to listening to them. You understand their challenges. Not, I know you need to do this, so just find a way to do it. You understand the hardships that come with, or maybe the challenges of that change that may come.
They're teaching me. I don't understand it other than the fact that they're teaching me. Now, listening is actually good business for me because I'm a documentary filmmaker.
Yes.
Right? Even though I just talked over you just now to say that, right? But if I'm smart, then I'm listening. And if I'm not smart, I'm talking too much. But it's funny. My house feels abnormally quiet right now because I sent my wife and two kids out to go do their homework someplace else so I could have this interview with you. Sounds like you have kids and they're not at home either. So how old are yours?
So my oldest boy just turned 7 last weekend. I have, a 4.5-year-old boy and an 18-month-old girl.
Oh, wow. You got 3. So my youngest boy just turned 7 last weekend.
Oh.
And our oldest turned 10, boy turned 10 in November. So we got 2.
And oh,
They're doing homework and I think they're probably eating Panera. So they're getting the best and worst of life right now from their perspective. So it's the farmers that are teaching everything. And in the making of the first of the Soil Carbon Cowboys films, it's actually called Soil Carbon Cowboys, which is why the whole series took on that name. I learned that there was a big giant gap in our scientific research around adaptive multi-paddock grazing or holistic management or mob grazing or any strip grazing, any number of titles for this type of grazing that these people are doing. These innovative farmers are replicating the way the herds are moving around the Great Plains, the way the herds of bison used to move around the Great Plains. And that's like they're tight in a pack and they hit an area really hard with their hooves and their manure and their urine. And then they move on either because wolves are coming or because just the food's better over there, right? Like, it seems that animals know what to eat. Like, there's a great scientist named Fred Provenza, and he's done all sorts of work showing that animals know exactly how to balance their diet if they're given the choice of a multi-species natural place to eat. They know when they need the protein. They know when they need this and that and all that stuff. And so animals really don't eat more than half of the plant naturally, just like we don't eat more than half of an asparagus.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of stomp down the rest, which covers the soil, feeds the microbes, and they move on. And so that's the basis of what these innovative ranchers are all experimenting with. How much time on the land, how big a herd, how small an area do you stay on? Do you stay for 2 hours or a day or somewhere in between? We've got a film called Herd Impact where the folks in Henrietta, Texas are moving 5,000 head of steer every 2 hours during the growing season. And it's just two people in their 60s and a field hand. And that's all they need. Because all you do is open a gate and the animals know the food's better. So they go on in. But what's missing is the research to show, are these folks storing more carbon in their soils than their conventionally grazing neighbors? Are they... What about the methane and the nitrous oxide, these greenhouse gases going into and out of that system? What about the soil microbial life? What about the insects above and below ground? what about the forages, the plants and the all the stuff? Are they growing more plants on the same area with the same rainfall? And are those plants more nutrient dense than their neighbors? And like, are the animals healthier? Are the farmers better off? Are they happier? Are they making more money? And where are the migratory birds, the breeding birds landing and nesting? And we're asking all these questions with our science. And so now, besides the films, we're leading a large research group to find out these questions to see if indeed amp grazing is a benefit to the farmer and to the land. And so that's the work we're doing right now. And so that comes out of the filmmaking. It's been pretty gosh darn exciting.
Absolutely. And just the questions that arise. I mean, obviously many of those I wouldn't have thought of myself since it's not my background, but it is interesting to see what's come out of that.
Yeah.
The one thing I was thinking about when you were talking, I was like, I wonder if that's because at first you said moving all these, you said cattle, is that what it was? Mm-hmm. With just the two of them in their 60s and a ranch hand. And yeah. I was thinking a lot more work, but then like you said, you're still looking into that, but they were just opening up and the animals just instinctively knew what to do.
Yeah. Logic says it's more work and the farmers say either A, it's less work or B, it's just different work and more enjoyable work. Oh. So in a conventionally grazed system, a lot of work is put into the plowing of a field, fertilizing it and planting hay. And then harvesting the hay, storing the hay, and then feeding the hay. And so a lot of farmers spend a lot of time doing that when the amp farmers are spending much less time doing any of the hay growing because they're growing much, much less hay, sometimes none. They might buy a little for a smaller window of time in the winter where they actually don't feed hay from November to February, because their soils are still producing more grass, more of the year, like longer into the fall, sooner into the spring, than their conventional neighbors who might be feeding hay 3 or 4 months out of the year and either growing all that hay and spending all that money or buying hay when they need to. So it's still work, but it's different work. These folks get to be with their herd all the time. They understand their soils more. And it is more creative and one of the things that some folks say is that some farmers just want to be told what to do, make it easy, let me leave the farm for a couple of weeks every season and have that life, which I understand. I like going to Florida. I love going to Florida, bringing my kids with me, and my wife. And I think that's the one thing that this amp grazing, you do need to be there more days. I'm seeing that. But I don't know, it seems like every farmer I've ever met is friends with their neighbors and neighbors help neighbors. So it might be something where they have someone help with the moves at a certain period of time and they can, you know, folks can sort of balance that out as well.
Right. And enjoy time with their family uninterrupted that we all enjoy.
Exactly.
But it's interesting too, the things you've talked about with the animals instinctively knowing what to do and playing with the idea of them moving around and planting or having different things grow by the season, I would assume, is how that would work. And it just seems like it's trying to go back to the way things were, but different because it can't be like it was before. At this point, I'm sure that's maybe impossible.
It's sort of both.
Right.
The idea of having one herd moving around a large piece of land is very much like it used to be. Mm-hmm. People used to farm their animals together in a large area, and you had the commons, right? That whole concept, and I guess it's an English law even, the law of the commons, I believe, is part of their legal history. But then when people started putting up a lot of fences, then it was just their herd on their land and those people's herd on that land, and they stopped actually getting the benefit of all that herd moving over all their land. So in that way, it is moving back to replicating nature. I think absolutely. And the idea of having your livestock and your row crop production on the same land, I think is what it used to be as well. Like a lot of folks, you know, their grandparents raised animals and now they raise row crops and they've torn down their exterior fence. So for them to add cattle back into their mix, they'd have to rebuild that exterior fence. So that's a cost of change.
Yes.
Installing in a lot of the electric fence is a cost. It's not a huge cost, but it is a cost. And so so there's a little bit of going back and a little bit of going forward at the same time. From what
right.
I
mean. Yeah. And making things work today. Because like I said, we, you know, here we are today, and how are we going to make that work in today's society?
Yeah.
Realistically, over time.
But one of our major funders is McDonald's. And so having it work today means there's a market for your food, right?
Right.
And so McDonald's has got pressure from two areas, from what I understand in my conversations with them. One is their customers want healthy food, maybe healthier food, and they want to know where their food's coming from. And then what's happening now is their investors are actually saying, what are you doing about climate change? What's your risk mitigation? What are you doing about it? So they've got these pressures coming together. The idea of sustainability is not new to McDonald's. They've been working on it for decades. But I think the pressure's ratcheting up and the focus of the company seems to be really sharp. And so when we came to them and said, we want to do this research, they were looking for either pilot projects or research projects. It was good timing. And so they've been great, great collaborators. And so if we, you know, as we move down the road, if our research shows, yes, this type of grazing is very good for the farmer, it's good for productivity, gets the animals in much better shape, then the idea of scaling up and educating as many farmers as possible becomes a real thing, a real opportunity. And one thing I do know, I'll say I know this, is that farmers don't like to be told what to do. I don't like to be told what to do. My wife's the nicest person in the world. She's the most considerate human being I've ever met, unless I try to tell her what to do. Then it's on me. But, right? And farmers are the most independent, spirited. Even the ones who still have a day job, they don't want that day job. They wish they were just running their show. And so what I think is the strongest method of affecting change is, A, discovering if indeed it's better for the farmer, one. Two, if we discover that it is better for the farmer, then give the farmer the information, incentivize them in any number of ways, but let them make the decision. Because it's the only way it's going to happen. It's like, it's almost stupid to say, let them make the decision. Of course they have to make the decision. They have to choose. You know, and what we think is, what we think could be the case is that it's riskier not to choose to go a more regenerative way of farming than to choose to go towards regenerative farming. Like the lower risk is actually changing.
Mm-hmm.
That risk is really, really real. It's a
right.
risk and a real risk. So how do we help that out? Well, education, methods, training, networking. Is there a loan or some sort of financial way to help them get over that hump of needing to get that exterior fence put in and the electric fence stuff put in? You know, how do we help? How do we help? How do we help?
What a project. There are so many questions that go into this. I do love that you say, you know, is it truly better for the farmer? I think that's a great question to pose. Like I know quite a few farmers, even some of the family, the hardest, working people I know. My husband grew up on a farm. He's, you know, super hard worker. And I love that about him. I know that work ethic is so huge. And I do appreciate, you know, the question of, is it truly better for the farmer? And you're going through this to see if it is, and you're looking at the financials, because we know that's in every case. So no matter what you do, finance is at the lead of that.
Of course, you got to pay the bills. Hey, I've just noticed that it's getting kind of dark where I'm at. Do you mind if I jump over and turn on a light real quick?
Oh, absolutely. Go for it.
Blank screen. What you get for getting a filmmaker on.
Hey, I love it. This is real. Podcasting is real.
There you go.
Real conversation.
Did that help? I think it did.
Yeah. Yep. There's definitely more light there. Absolutely. So I'm kind of going back a little bit. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say that these are paintings from my dad, who it's been almost 10 years since I lost him. And so I just love having those in the background when I'm
really.
Yeah, so just a story.
Hey, I think it's interesting. It's a real thing to have that you can really think about your father. 10 years. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. I love that piece. What's that?
It sucks to lose a parent.
I can't imagine. And I am not looking forward to the day.
Don't even think about it. You'll have plenty of time later. Don't waste a second while they're still around.
Right?
Absolutely.
Oh, you know, I do agree with you. My parents are awesome. They're in town, luckily, so they do a ton for me and my kids. So I just, you know, I tell them all the time I'm very grateful for their help and just being around. So I absolutely agree with you. Enjoy it while they're here. And
did you ever cause trouble when you were a kid?
Oh my gosh, no. And I can say that honestly, I have four brothers, two older, two younger. And I really think I was the shyest little girl. Oh my goodness. I probably hardly said a peep in school, but I think I remember just like watching my brothers or like bossing the younger ones around when my parents weren't around probably. Mm-hmm. But no, I think I just watched my brothers and felt that was probably enough for them. Got and it. So I should be the well-behaved one.
I was just saying, if you ever cause trouble, then is your mom sort of watching you deal with the same trouble, going, "Yep, it's coming." So obviously, that's not your.
No, not at all. She wants to help more, having five kids. I mean, herself, that she wants to help since she didn't have loads of it herself. She goes, "No, we want to be here and we want the grandkids to love coming over." And I'm like, yeah. "You're fabulous."
Yeah, no, I loved my grandmother. She was awesome. I got to spend a lot of time with her in Kentucky. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, no, having grandparents around, and my wife's from South Africa, so we just spent December down with her mom in the small town in the Western Cape of South Africa. So it's great to have the kids get to know their grandmother more. It's very important.
Oh my gosh, and traveling, that's amazing. Yeah.
The kids are good. They like a good flight. As long as there's movies playing, they're in good shape.
Thankfully, these days, there's so many ways to keep yourself entertained while you're traveling long distances.
Yeah, we keep saying, don't you think you ought to go to sleep? No, no, there's free movies.
Right. No. Yeah, and my kids won't even fall asleep to movies either. Wide awake until you, like, force them to go to bed.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is. They're like, won't they just fall asleep?
So how do you feed your kids? What do you think about when you're feeding your kids?
Oh, great question. This is probably one of the biggest stressors probably I have as a parent, honestly, because I probably went on my journey, I would say about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Health, it's still a work in progress, obviously, but of what's important to me. And so my youngest daughter, she eats so much better than my boys because that's how I was eating. I was eating well when she was born, and so she was introduced to so many new things, and now I feel like I'm trying to backtrack with my boys, and I think that is the stress because I know what's in these foods and what's not good for them and what it's doing to their bodies, and it may not be now, but over time into adulthood, and I'm just trying to find creative ways, bean pastas, you know, just different things to sneak the healthier food in as they acquire new tastes.
Yeah, it was interesting. We've got two boys, and my wife was absolutely fully in charge of their what they ate for years, besides breastfeeding, when she started making all the baby food for them. And our oldest boy ate everything all the time, just totally had a, you know, just anything you put in front of him, he'd give it a try. Our youngest one, not at all. And it's just interesting. It's the same kid, there's, you know, same family, same mom, same dad, same house, but just totally different. Just out of the gate, just eating totally different stuff. And so I'm constantly banging my head against the wall with my youngest one. Like, if you don't eat that, you won't be as tall as your brother. And you know, trying to incentivize in some way, shape, or form. Don't you want to beat him up when you're older? You know,
right. Hey, that's a big deal to brothers. I know to my two boys it is. No, it's hard, and it's something that I, you know, I'm not giving up on. I'm still trying to, I mean, when it comes to fruits, they'll eat most fruits you give them. So, I mean, that part's, it's great. I'm struggling with the vegetables is where, yes, hiding them in things, trying to get them to eat like smoothies and different, not hiding. I like them to know they're there, so they know they're eating them, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge.
Hiding might not be a bad idea.
Yeah.
It makes everything green, so it's kind of hard to hide.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. They're like sugar obsessed. So I don't give them much sugar, but that wonderful grandpa of theirs in town, that's how he shows his love. Lots of cookies. No, we're working on that.
I think we all eat too much sugar in our house probably.
Oh, absolutely.
We have absolutely. A
Mm-hmm. We do too. And it's mainly chocolate in our house.
Yes, indeed.
It's hard. It's hard. But I'm trying to go back. It's just interesting. You brought up McDonald's and you know, there's always behind the scenes things going on that you don't realize as just, you know, an everyday consumer out there. But it's nice to see these thoughts are there and they're aware that the public wants a bit more transparency with the food they're eating. So I just want to kind of bring that up saying I love that those questions are being asked and that it's being looked into.
Yeah, I think it's a very serious part of their work. Yeah, I don't think they're giving it short shrift. I don't think they're just sort of going, well, let's just paper this one over and we'll fake people out. I think they're quite genuine.
Right.
The more I know them, the more I realize that. It's really good.
Oh, that's so great to hear. And I'm hoping that keeps coming.
Yeah, you can see change at a large level. The company that big, they buy more meat than any other company on the planet. Oh. So if they say, we want this, and here's how we want to help you get to it. I don't think they'd ever say you must do this, because I think, again, you that's not how you get farmers to join. Mm-hmm. But hey, we think this is going to make you more money and all that stuff. I think it could be really, really, really cool.
Absolutely.
And who else can we bring on board, right? What other big companies can we bring on board?
See, and that's the more I want to see, because I just think about myself as the more Whole Foods I really try to eat. I try to follow more just for inflammation reasons. I had a major back issues a couple years ago, which set me down this path, right? It always takes something, I feel sometimes. But I've tried a lot of anti-inflammatory foods to try to help, you know, obviously reduce inflammation, help me move better. And when I want something quick to eat, there's really, I mean, if I'm at home, yes, I plan to make, but if I'm like out running around, I look around like there's really not much I can do without truly knowing where this food is coming from. Obviously, I make mistakes and I still do stop sometimes. Like I said, journey. But
did you have an injury or a health issue? Or
herniated disc. So it wasn't my first one. I'm very much someone who like less is more. You know, try to heal things yourself. And it finally got to the point I was stuck in bed when I birthed my daughter. My husband had to like pretty much get me out of bed. I couldn't go anywhere. It was awful. The first month of her life, I was stuck in bed. Wow. And that's when he was, you know, making me tons of veggies and fruits and beans and bring it to me in bed when he was home and my family. And I noticed what a difference it made just in my health overall, my skin, my energy level, just everything about it. My eyes were just open to it. Like I said, I still have many fails, but I'm happy with where I'm at today. I'm better than I was a year ago, better, you know, a year before that. So
hey, just think of how many other people are eating differently right now. And when you multiply that by everyone who's thinking like these, that shows up for all sorts of food companies, all sorts of food processors. They feel that shift, like Cargill feels that shift. And so you've had herniated discs. Were you lifting something too heavy?
No, I think it's, well, aside from the more I've looked into this, probably just, you know, poor food habits growing up, but also it's in my family. I have a couple brothers with bad backs, my dad. So it's also just some genes in there as well, as I feel, you know, the foods I ate, you know, I don't control over what foods I ate. So end up did having surgery. Just couldn't, I was not going to be able to go back to work and take care of my children. And it did work out wonderfully. I had a great surgeon. So I am thankful.
You're lucky. Congratulations on that. Cause that can go either way.
It can. And that's why I did not want to have surgery, but it got to the point where I could not even imagine the pain. I even to this day, still can't imagine the pain I was in.
You're a mom of three and you're a kindergarten teacher?
Yeah. You got to have energy, you know?
Are you lifting the kids at school? Are you needing to do that, or can you sort of avoid that part of it?
Nope, not at all. Actually, I think teaching is one of the best professions you can have for a bad back. You're moving a ton. And that's what you need to do. You need to be able to move. So I'm moving. I'm sitting down. I'm talking to the kids. We're up dancing. We're moving. You know, it's great. It's great. It's what I need. Like I said, the kids are there just as much for me. So you also brought up earlier sustainability, and that's a word too that's for a while almost seemed kind of like a buzzword, but it's not. So what's your take on sustainability, or what does that mean to you?
I kind of like what Gabe Brown says, who's one of the farmers in our first film, Soil Carbon Cowboys. He's like, he basically, in a nutshell, is like, why would I want to sustain this? I need to regenerate. Mm. Sort of like, what's beyond sustainability? What's beyond, you know, so that you can regenerate? But when I think of sustainability, I was taught by some folks at my, I teach at ASU in the School of Sustainability and the School of Journalism.
I saw that, yeah.
And so the Dean of Sustainability, he really taught me the people aspect of sustainability. Like when you have a city and all of a sudden they sort of tear down this area where folks who don't make a lot of money live and build these beautiful green, you know, LEED platinum buildings, are those buildings truly sustainable if all those people who used to live there can't afford to live there now? And so what about the people in any kind of decision? So I like that. I'm learning about that. I'm learning about how right. people fit into the word sustainability. And so each semester I teach students how to make short documentaries from both the journalism school and the School of Sustainability. And this semester I asked them to really think about the people, you know, the forgotten people, like how sustainable is a society if we can't take care of our veterans, right? The people who've made the biggest sacrifices, whose families have made the biggest sacrifices, and we can't take care of them, I don't think that's a sustainable society. And it's something that needs to be looked at a lot more. I wish there was more TV shows of veterans interviewing veterans and we just get to sit back and listen to them talk, because they could teach us a lot of what we're not doing right. So that's what sustainability means to me now is more about, you know, are we taking care of people, right? How sustainable is agriculture if the farmers aren't making enough money?
Right.
How sustainable is agriculture if the farmers are in debt producing our food? How sustainable is education if the teachers are in debt teaching our children, right? So those are the things that I'm thinking about these days. What's really going to make it work, our society, and that is teachers that are well-paid, farmers that are well-paid, and kids that are well-fed, you know? Once you're an adult, I guess it's up to you, but let's make it easier for families to feed their kids well.
I totally agree. That's an interesting take. I've heard a lot about sustainability, and that's been something I've asked about. And everyone's brought up people, but I like how you actually said, let's look at the people. And that's an interesting take on it. And I also make it easier for families to buy nutritious foods for their children. I mean, what's the cheapest to buy? The sugary-filled cereals or desserts, anything in the middle of the store, you know, like the mac and cheese. I mean, there's great mac and cheese out there, but I mean more of like the easy macs. Like mac and cheese. Oh, I do too. I made it for my kids today for lunch.
The mac and cheese is really good.
Yes, at least with mac and cheese, I can pick whole grain noodles for my kids, like some decent ones. It's a little different. I tried anything little I can do for my boys, I try.
Hey, I got a question for you. In your research of nutritious food and food mm-hmm. that makes you feel better, are you seeing that it's good to eat whole fats? Are you on the world of eat low fat or no fat? Where are you at in that fat world, that fat debate?
Oh, fat's great. Yeah. I think the healthy fats, I think you have to consider where it comes from. But I used to, you know, I'm sure I've yo-yo dieted my whole life. This is the first time the last year and a half, 2 years, I'd have to look back to the date, where I have not worried about my weight. I'm not fluctuating. I'm going down. And when I do step on the scale, I'm like, oh, because it's just a surprise because I'm not doing it for that reason anymore. I'm doing it to be healthy for my kids. And I think it's that mind shift. So I'm eating, you know, loads of fiber, you know, those vegetables I'm eating, plenty of beans, tons mm-hmm. of fruit, you know, some whole grains during the day, you know, avocado, great fat right there. And I'm always plenty full. I'm not counting calories. I'm eating to the point where I'm comfortable and I'm happy with my food. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, and there's fat in there and I'm not counting it at all. It's just, you know, whatever I feel my body needs. And it's been great.
Yeah. I'm on full fat yogurt and I don't drink a lot of milk. I never have liked it, but I put milk in tea, which is what I'm drinking with this red cup. And then I'll have if I'm home, which has been half of this year or three quarters of this year, otherwise I've been on the road. But when I'm home, I make a smoothie, you know, those bullets, those ones that really just blend everything together. Mm-hmm. Those things changed my life. I've always made like fruitcakes for breakfast since I was in college. That was decades ago. But I put spinach and whole yogurt, a banana, some flax seed. And but I'm now realizing I want to get more nuts into my mix.
Mm-hmm. Yep, nuts are great too. Yes,
I want to buy a lot more bulk nuts and have that sort of be like the thing I eat to go exercise, and then I'll come home and have the smoothie. I think that's what I'm gonna be going for next, is getting those nuts in there.
Oh yeah,
bread or something like that.
That's a great choice. Yeah, my husband, he's a smoothie guy every morning. I tend to have a harder time in the winter with it. I don't know if I want something warm in the morning.
I like it all year round. It's actually, we were on the road with our science project this summer for 2 months, and the camera guy, my camera guy and I, we just had a smoothie station in the hotel.
Great.
We'd just go anywhere, Walmart, Target, wherever we could just get. And we always had the spinach and the juice and something else.
Oh, they're so good. And they're so quick.
They're quick and they're easy to digest. Yes. That's why I started it. I was in college. I didn't have time. I wanted to get up to school. I wanted to get going. Mm-hmm. And just throwing a cantaloupe and a banana in a blender with whatever else was around, that was like it for years.
Well, and you're eating healthy though, because think about a lot of the other breakfast options we have out there that I've also eaten. You but feel I better.
Eggs now that my friends are talking about, you know, eggs aren't the devil. Right. You like deviled eggs. But you know, I have had more eggs now than I used to, but yeah, but biscuits, man. When I was in the South this summer, when we were doing our research, a good biscuit, but you just don't have one every day.
No, see, exactly. You can't, if you completely deprive yourself, you're going to fall off and you're gonna be like, this is too hard. I'm just going to eat whatever's around. Yeah. My boys love biscuits too.
I tried making a couple. I found a couple of recipes. I actually found a recipe in the New York Times that was pretty good. I was on the road this summer, so I haven't made them in a while, but I'm going to try them again.
See, you're always thinking. That's the good part. You're thinking about what, you know, you want to put in your body. That's a start for everyone, I think.
I think food that makes you happy does have a certain value, maybe not every meal all the time.
Exactly. It truly is, because my son's birthday was this weekend. I had some cake. I did. I mean, I didn't feel very good at night, so there's that trade-off, but I did. And the next birthday, I'll have it again. I already know I will.
It's pretty easy for me to say no to store-bought cakes right now. If I'm going for desserts, I'm picking something that I really like.
See, my mother-in-law makes our cakes for the birthdays, and they are so delicious. She's so great at them. I know. I get it. So you're kind of, you know, bring up a lot about food. And like you said, I think you do need to indulge. I think it's just, you know, part of our society, and you kind of feel like you're giving up too much. And really it should be thinking about, you know, what can you eat? You know, it's kind of changing that mindset of what we do. And so, you know, with Biteable Foods, we really care about transparency in our food. And that's kind of why we're trying to, you know, get this podcast out there for people that may also care more about transparency in their food, but just are not quite sure, you know, maybe why it's important or what they can do to kind of maybe drive that demand that obviously McDonald's is hearing, which is great. So what does transparency in food mean to you, or why is it important to you?
Well, I think it's important because it's nice to know where the food came from.
Yeah.
Because we've had moments where we lose faith in our food system, right? But I think our food system is a heck of a lot safer than other countries. But right now with the government shutdown, we're at a precarious place because there's a lot less people checking our food, and they're checking things like fish a lot less right now. And so I take that for granted. I take it for granted that the food I'm about to eat is safe. So that's one thing. I like the idea of knowing where my steak came from. I would like to know the farmer. I would like every steak to have the farm on there. Why not? I think that'd be really cool. I think it'd be cool for the farmer. I think it'd be really cool for me. And that's not dissimilar to what it was like in small towns 30, 40 years ago and back. You went to the butcher who knew whose steak he was processing that day. You actually did know. And then does that make the farmer a little bit more conscientious about, well, they're going to know I made that steak or I produced that animal. So my name's on there. So does that give people a little bit more pause before any corner cutting might happen? I don't know. that's certainly something that one of the farmers I've filmed talked about. But there are no, virtually are no more small processing plants and things like that. And so, but yeah, to know that that steak was made and that animal was raised in Missouri, that animal was raised in New York, and I think that could be really cool. Really cool. So well, that it gives would need transparency. That would need to have that.
Right. And it gives appreciation back to that farmer too. You know, you really get to appreciate that piece of meat that's on your table because you know exactly where it came from and you know that farmer and he or she worked really hard, you know, to produce that for you.
Yeah. I put my name on my films. I want people to know what I've made. Mm-hmm. Right. And your name will be on this podcast.
Absolutely.
So why wouldn't we want folks' names to be on the food they produce? I think that would be really, really cool.
Oh, I think it is cool. And nowadays, I feel like you can go to some places in the grocery store or even some restaurants, and they'll have a sign up saying where maybe a fruit or vegetable came from or, you know, a slab of meat. And I think that's really cool. So I am seeing bits of pieces starting to change, and I think people are listening to the consumers. And I think that's really exciting.
But that's sort of like the more expensive places that have that, right? They sort mm-hmm. of tell you they're sourcing their food. You know, I want to know just where the strawberries are coming from, the blueberries and things like that. I had a really sad moment to me. I was back home in Kentucky, and I just sort of sometimes just drive out to the country and just see where the car takes me and try to get lost and then try to find my way back, you know, without a map, just to give that a pop. And I was in this small town outside of Louisville, and they had a produce stand, and I went in there. And I got a peach, and I'm thinking, oh, cool, Kentucky peach, maybe a Georgia peach. It's from California. And that means that peach was picked before it was ripe, mm-hmm. yep. so it could make the shipment. It was then sprayed with a chemical solution to make it look ripe, which is not really the way to get a good tasty peach. So I was so bummed out. And so sometimes when you're driving around the country, it's hard to find the produce made in that area. You gotta work at it. Mm-hmm. Really work at it. And that to me is a shame because so much food production went to California because nuclear energy was going to be too cheap to meter. Therefore, they could build a whole big aqueduct system to make it irrigate everything when so much of the food east of the Mississippi should be produced east of the Mississippi. There's enough rain. It tastes better. So that's sort of a very interesting thing I've learned in my research, that whole thing of how much food went out to California. Then you got to ship it back, and you got to pick it before it's ripe or it won't make the shipment back. Then you got to spray it to make it look like it's ripe. And then it doesn't taste very good. The nutrient level can't be very high.
No.
So that all is part of that transparency piece that you're asking about, you know, and just makes sense. You know, you've got so much land east of the Mississippi with so many people east of the Mississippi. And there's so many young people that want to farm, too. So it seems like there's a whole lot of yes, yes, yes on that.
Oh, people absolutely.
Raised on farms. They're just, it's a thing right now.
It's like, how does that change? Because I've even been hearing, I've done some podcasts with a few chefs, and they're actually saying, yeah, you know, frozen fruits, absolutely good. Because at that point, you know, they're freeze-dried so quickly that their nutrients are probably still in there more than that peach you were trying to find. So that was interesting to me. And I was like, oh, I never thought of it that way. I kind of thought frozen fruit, well, it's convenient, I'll use it, but it's still not the best. So I felt a little bit about that. I still need to look into that more, but that's just something I had heard. So,
and some people really like a cold smoothie, and therefore the frozen fruit actually acts like the ice and it yep. does all that stuff. I myself don't like it really cold. Somewhere along the way, I read that really cold food is not good for at least my stomach, if not all of our stomachs.
Yes, I have heard that.
We have a wide spectrum of humanity, so maybe some people, cold food's really good for them. But for me, I'm more of a room temp guy, if I can help it. But, you know, a lot of the fruits we leave in the fridge, and just because it'll stay fresher longer is important.
Right, right.
But it's frozen. It's not ice.
Well, and I think what our bodies get used to, we may think we're fine with, you know, the frozen. It's just all we know because it's all we've done. I've done that. I've tried different foods, and I'm like, I thought I had felt fine this whole time. And then I tried these new foods, and it treated me even better. Or I thought that rice was making me feel lethargic, and it wasn't the rice. It was the other things, or it was the type of rice. It's just, you know, playing with your body and seeing what works for you. And
Now, don't get me wrong. I love ice. It's just not for breakfast. Once I start eating ice, drinking iced tea or the occasional Coke, man, fill that thing full of ice. When I travel to like South Africa and Europe, you know, they give you 3 cubes and they think that's enough ice. And I guess in those cultures it is. But I always say, I need more ice. I know. I get it. But can you fill it up? And then they fill it up and I'm like, thank you.
And, perfect. Good to go.
But yeah, no. The iced tea is essential to my well-being when it gets warm.
Oh, absolutely. I love iced tea. So this is probably complete backtrack, but I'm curious. So you just have this passion for what you do. How did you get started on this?
Well, starting in film and making films was when I was 15 and I heard the term film school. And I was like, film school? And I would see any movie I liked 4 times. I would hitchhike to movies if no one would drive me. I loved music and I loved taking pictures. So it's just like, that feels really good. And so that was the beginning, right? And then most of my films have had something to do with environment or the lack thereof. And so that was just sort of naturally what I did. And then with Carbonation, looking for solutions to climate change, that became something that felt really, really, really good. It felt like a purpose. And I was looking for solutions. So I was constantly looking for solutions. And staying in that hunt for solutions has also felt really, really good. And it felt good to our funders that we found. They themselves liked that we were focused on solutions. So it helped me raise the money to make the movies. And it felt really good to the audiences who saw it because they realized they could be really scared and unproductive, or they could be inspired and looking for solutions. And for me, when I'm scared, I'm very unproductive. So I'm constantly looking for people to inspire me, constantly looking for things to inspire me, because sometimes I can't rev up the engine all by myself. You know, I need that help. I need other people. And so focusing on solutions felt really good. And then working on agriculture as a solution to climate change is why I came into it. Most of the farmers I work with are not, that's not where they're coming from, is climate change concern. But I let them know that's where I came from. But now I'm equally as passionate about helping the farmers as anything else. So now I've got that going, you know, feeding my engine. And then learning about how poor our soils are writ large and knowing how much help the soils need and knowing that it's doable, that revs my engine. And so this is the whole thing. And so it's basically what's inspiring me. And I'm now where I've got a life where I can follow that. You know, I'm making documentary filmmaking films, which is difficult. It can be incredibly up and down on the income level. I've been incredibly fortunate to get hired by ASU to teach students to do what I do. And so that's given me a nice steady paycheck from which to then build this large research project, which was something that just happened organically, but it wasn't something I was hired for. So it's a benefit to the university. It's a benefit to me. It's a benefit to all the companies we're working with because they're looking for solutions. And it's a benefit for the farmers. The ones who are innovators now get their stories told. And the folks who are curious about it, they get to learn. Like, their neighbors are watching. Their neighbors don't think they're crazy, which is what we thought people thought. Their neighbors are watching them. And they're going, I can see they've got more forage than I've got. I can see their animals look really good. But they're too polite to ask.
Interesting.
I'm not too polite to ask. So I'm respectful, right? But I'm not too polite. And so I realized that in the filmmaking and the research we're doing, we can actually help connect some neighbors, which is really cool. That's just something we were finding out this summer. And, you know, who knows where that's going to lead. But just neighbors that are friends, they're just too polite to sort of toot their own horn or ask what the other one's up to. It's a very personal thing, the way people farm. I'm discovering, I'm learning. It's a very personal thing. And how you talk about it to others, what you talk about, seems to be very almost delicate.
Yeah.
So you have to respect that delicacy, right? Or I I like to respect that delicacy, and I like to respect that it's very personal. But I like asking personal questions, and I do it from, like I said, from a place of respect, because, you know, that's always worked for me, and I'm lucky.
Well, and you can tell that about you, that you're generally interested, and people pick up on that if you're actually interested or if you're trying to get at something bigger or, you know, a different agenda. And you, I mean, from talking to you tonight, you don't seem that way, and you really seem to get people too. Like, you're trying to see where they're coming from, or maybe see challenges that they may have, or, you know, just saying, hey, great job on what you're already doing. You just, and people feel that, and they, that's probably why they're able to give you the information, you know, that you're looking for, is because they know you're out there also trying to help. You know, yeah. Solutions focused.
Exactly. I'm not trying to shut anyone down. I'm not trying to say you're doing it wrong. A buddy of mine taught me that phrase, no blame, no shame, a long time ago in my life. And his name's Luke Phillips out of South Carolina. And if you're seeing this, man, I can't find your number. I don't know where you are. Seriously, I've lost my friend. I don't know where he is.
Oh, no. Yeah, I hope you find him through this podcast.
Yeah, it would be awesome. There's another Luke Phillips in South Carolina, but he's not the Luke Phillips I'm looking for.
Oh, no. That's kind of a sad story. I hope you find him.
Yeah, make it a happy story.
I'm hoping it ends happy. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, we don't want you to become lost like your good friends. So how can people find you? Or are there certain things you would like them to search for if they're interested?
Yeah, our everything's on our website, soilcarboncowboys.com. You can learn about our research. You can see the 10 short films we've made. You can see who's on our science team. Everything's there. It's not a complete website, but it's got enough going right now.
Right. Yeah. And people can find the information, because I think this is really interesting, especially hearing it from a perspective of, you know, we're searching, we're trying to find solutions, and we're caring about everyone involved.
Yep.
And who doesn't love that?
That's pretty much it.
And I love it. Well, Peter, I really appreciate you having you on tonight. Is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with before we
get out of just here? Thank you, and good luck healing your back and raising your kids.
Thanks.
How lucky all those parents are to have you as a kindergarten teacher. And, you know, thank you.
Well, I appreciate me as, you know, teacher to teacher. We know it's a lot of hard work, but it really is very rewarding. We hear that all the time. But, you know, if I'm having a bad day from the morning, those kindergartners make sure it is long forgotten when they walk in that door.
They put you right in the moment, don't they?
They do. And I need that. So I love that about them, that their parents share them with me, you know, for the day. So it's fabulous. Like I said, thanks for all you do. I'm curious to checking out your website as well as the listeners.
Yeah. Watch the movies. Tell me what you think.
I will. Absolutely.
They're all free, so people can show them to other friends. They can have screenings. They can do whatever they want with them. They're all free. Our donors and funders, all, that's what it's all about.
Oh, fabulous. That's even better.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for taking your time out. Thank your wife, too, for helping you get the kids out of the house for some Panera homework.
There you go. All right. Have a great day.
Bye. Thanks, Peter.
Bye-bye.
We'd like to remind our audience that the views of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Biteable or of our staff personally. The purpose of the Biteable podcast is to encourage spirited dialogue around topics like food, nutrition, animal and human welfare, and the food system. Part of having an open and spirited dialogue is accepting that others have views that are different than ours and working to understand how their experiences have differed from our own. We encourage all listeners to do their own research on any and all topics discussed during the show. That being said, we hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thanks for listening.